welcome to Pop Unlock. I'm Landry Ayers. Holy cinematic criticism! It may have been less than a decade since we saw him last, but the Batman has got a new haircut, a fresh coat of eyeshadow, and a lot of emotional baggage to unpack. Here with me are a trio of bat specialists who I know are up to the task, including returning guest and senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Julian Sanchez.
Thanks, old chum.
Fellow at the Center for a Stateless Society and coming back to us again, Corey Massimino.
Hey there, thanks for having me on again.
And joining us for the first time here on Pop Unlock, we are excited to have Communications Director for Daily Kos, Carolyn Fidler.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I read a tweet recently that outlined the timeline of how many times Batman had been rebooted since the original film adaptation came out in 1960. So, 89, 2005, 2016, 2022, and kind of proposed jokingly that given sufficient extrapolation, we will have a new Batman reboot every 15 microseconds by the year 2050. So all of these superhero films these days are kind of divorced from their self-contained messages. They are at least inevitably in conversation with one another. So what does this Batman, the sort of Matt Reeves Batman, have to say that is different than all of the others that had come before it? Or what has he brought back to the forefront?
So I think, in a way, this is a kind of Batman that you could only do as a reboot because it exists very much in dialogue with prior incarnations of the character in film, as well as in the many different versions that appeared in the comics, which is to say, this movie kind of pulls a fast one, right? You look at the trailers and the beginning of the movie, and you think you're going to get the grim darkest of the grim dark Batmans, right? A kind of a viscerally brutal, savage guy in the vein of Zack Snyder's gleefully murderous Batfleck, despite all the smarty pants detective work he does. This is a guy who likes doing violence. In a way, the story of the movie, which is maybe Corey will disagree, but I think this is one of the only film adaptations where really Batman has a clear character arc. He actually changes over the course of it and sees through something false he believed about himself and his motivations. So this is, and this is, something we've seen a lot in the comics. Grant Morrison has done this to some extent in his runs on the character is, hey, the thing that was brilliant about 80s comics like Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns wasn't that they were brutal and cynical and dark and violent all the time. Doing a realistic and mature take on these comics characters doesn't mean making them joyless bastards like Zack Snyder thinks. It's okay to be a little Silver Age. Maybe that doesn't mean you're flying around with shark repellent bat spray and giant dinosaurs, having Batman visit the Hollow Earth or dress up in rainbow colored costumes every day. But he doesn't just have to be this brooding jerk who is nothing but vengeance all the time. Batman should also be a protector and a symbol of hope, not just someone who scares criminals, but someone who makes ordinary people feel safe. In a lot of ways, if this had been, it would have been great if this had been the first modern Batman movie, but it wouldn't have landed really the same way. I think in a lot of ways, this Batman is a statement about how we have understood Batman and what it means to have a grounded and realistic and mature take on Batman.
I would agree with pretty much all of that, but also this is the first Batman movie that really is a response to and incorporates elements of the comic universe in all its various aspects more than any other Batman movie that I've ever seen, even the very comic booky Batman and Robin. This movie owes more to the comic books than any other Batman movie aside from it existing. Really the movie's mostly just a love letter to Jeff Loeb. but it's much easier to appreciate that after seeing all the comic, all the movie iterations that came before, many of which were quite good. I'm a huge fan of the original Batman and, of course, Dark Knight. Pretty great.
The message of this movie, I totally agree with Julian, and that was the most surprisingly pleasant part of this film. By the end, it's absolutely a repudiation of what you thought it might be, of in many ways, previous iterations. You know, I mean, the thematic emphasis on redemption, I thought, was just fantastic, and it's not what I expected necessarily from the first trailers. And especially, like you said, it is in dialogue with the other Batman, you know, the Tim Burton Batman. I mean, that whole world, everyone in that world has fallen. There's no redemption for anyone, I don't think, with those characters. And then in Nolan, none of the villains are sympathetic. I felt like this movie, like, actually got a lot of those elements that are in the comics a lot, as well as something like the animated series, and brought it to life finally.
And let me just because I cataloged this, I want to. Or, you know, the ones I could think of, and I'm sure others could think of more. It's almost impressive how many recognizable beats in the movie are just very clearly borrowed from different great Batman story arcs. So the this idea of a serial killer who's targeting the Falcone crime family and corrupt public officials, that's straight from, as Carolyn noted, Jeff Loeb's Long Halloween. Which Nolan actually borrows a bit from as well. Selina Kyle being Falcone's daughter is from the sequel to Long Halloween, Loeb's Dark Victory. Most of the rest of the portrait of Selina Kyle is from Frank Miller's Year One. And in fact, some of the exterior shots through the window of her apartment seem to me almost like direct lifts from like frames of that comic. The Waynes being political figures, and Alfred being not really so much a butler, but a kind of security chief for the Waynes, who was actually the one who trained Bruce. That's from Jeff Johns's Batman Earth One. The scene where there's a mugging victim who, after Batman sort of saves him, is actually even more scared of Batman and is saying, "Please don't hurt me," is a straight lift of a frame from Grant Morrison's Gothic. The idea of the villain, spoilers, but, you know, don't listen to this if you haven't seen the movie yet. The villain was raised at a squalid orphanage where he's resentful of the much more famous and rich orphan, Bruce Wayne, is straight from Scott Snyder's City of Owls arc, which is sort of the sequel to The Court of Owls. In that case, with a villain who literally thinks he's Bruce Wayne's brother and might be. There's like a head fake from the Hush comics. There's a reporter whose death is indirectly attributable to the Waynes, whose last name is Elliot. I looked to my friends in the theater and said, "Oh, they're setting this up. It's not really Riddler. It's Hush from the Hush comics. Hush is a villain named Thomas Elliot." So that was just like an Easter egg to freak the fans out. The idea of Riddler flooding Gotham City is from Zack Snyder's Zero Year. The sort of the thematic threat of the Bruce Wayne personality being kind of completely consumed by Batman is from Darwin Cook's Ego. I'm sure there's more than that. But just a lot more than most other Batman movies, you can kind of, as you're kind of going through it, go, "Oh, that's from, you know, not just the general Batman mythos, but this is from a specific story arc." So they really mind that. And it's actually impressive that the movie feels cohesive as it does, and not like just a kind of weird pastiche of influences.
I also love how it doesn't just riff on these plot elements from classic Batman stories, but like just the one thing I really appreciated was like opening and closing the movie with that voiceover of Batman talking to the audience, and made it feel much more like the comics, where you almost always have access to his inner voice and perspective. And I'm surprised none of the other Batman movies ever wanted to do something like that. And that was very effective here and made it feel more like the books as well.
I mean, I think that's something that they kind of get away with because this is such a noir film, and that's kind of a noir convention. I think in general, in modern film, there's a sense that like voiceovers are kind of a cheat, and you're probably, you know, not a very good filmmaker if you have to rely on a voiceover to convey information that the audience needs. But here it works, I think, pretty well. It works as an interesting setup, right? Because the very first shot of the movie is, right, this kind of long, lingering Hitchcockian pan across an apartment building, and you see a kid through the window, and we're kind of programmed by the previous movies to think, oh, this must be young Bruce Wayne. But no, it's not. It's like the family of the Riddler's first victim. But so we're seeing through the eyes of the victim, of the Riddler, the absolute first shot of the movie. And then, you know, one of the first things we hear, the first voice we hear, well, it's like a TV screen, but then Bruce Wayne's voiceover. And I think that sets up an interesting contrast, right? Bruce Wayne is kind of, at least at the start of the movie, completely sort of self-obsessed and ruminating and like keeping an emo journal about what a creature of the night he is. And Riddler...
That had a very Black Casebook vibe, speaking of references and things that were...
And so Riddler is more outer-directed, right? He's the one who sees more. In fact, there's a parallel set up between the first time you see both characters, right? You see Riddler first. He's kind of hidden in the dark in the background. And then a light, I think, from the TV sort of suddenly illuminates him. Not him, just his glasses. So the first time you see Riddler is as a silhouette that becomes detectable as a light shines on his glasses and lights up. So, hey, this is a character who sees, and in particular, sees more clearly than Bruce Wayne does. And then there's this parallel. Then the first time we see Batman directly mimics this as he is emerging from the shadow that criminals have been kind of gazing into, constantly fearing that Batman is in one of them. And then it turns out he is finally in one of them.
Well, also sort of voiceovers, as in like just sort of inner thoughts, are another big comic book convention that he really successfully lifted for this, which, as you mentioned, is really well done, because it is easy for that to kind of seem cheesy and cheap and not earned, but it worked really well here. And yeah, the whole thing was, I mean, there are many things about the movie that I loved. A few things I really didn't love, but mostly it was just such a love letter to comic book fans, especially Batman fans, obviously, but comic book fans generally, while also being a really great movie at the same time. I am just super impressed that he pulled that off.
What was the Black Casebook lift you mentioned?
Oh, just the nature of the journal, the way it looked, the kind of voiceover while he's like writing in it. It's a super deep cut.
I liked how the voice, like, I agree, the voiceover can so often be lazy. So it was nice here. It wasn't, almost none of it was like mere exposition or delivering plot to the audience. It was for the purpose of characterization. The plot would have functioned perfectly fine, I think, without what he says to the audience. But the fact that it like deepens his character, deepens your like immersion into him as a character, it helps too, because in prior Batman movies, such a major complaint has him being out, outshined by the villains. So here, getting into his POV is very effective for that arc.
Speaking of who we sort of conceive of as the villain in this movie, obviously we can talk about the Riddler, all of his riddles, and the sort of meaning behind them. But I think tied up in that is the sort of complicated relationship with who is really the villain in all of this, who is really at fault, and what the Riddler is trying to expose and bring into the light is that the people in power, these, you know, hierarchies, and specifically, you know, politicians and police, the people that, you know, enact certain policies and actions and violence upon people, that they are the ones who are the real enemies here. And Batman's interactions with police in this movie are really, really interesting to me, especially compared to like what we see in the Christopher Nolan stuff, because as Julian had mentioned before, Batman is actually helping to solve crimes in this movie. He is not just coming out of the shadows and, you know, beating people up. He does plenty of that, and that might be, you know, sort of where he gets his kicks and like really sorts through his emotional baggage and why we get this emo Batman. But, you know, they do, to his credit, make him more of a, it has a noir angle too. It's much more than that. He's with Commissioner Gordon, not just on the rooftops of buildings, but he's at crime scenes and he's looking at evidence, and then he's taking it home and cracking ciphers with Alfred's help, and, you know, doing all of these things in a little bit more of a like a gumshoe style type hero than we've gotten in the sort of very heroic swoop down from the dark rich boy with a bunch of gadgets Batman previously. And then you've got the arc of like citywide corruption going on and the sort of weird cooperation with police in this movie jumped out at me most of all when they're arresting Falcone and bringing him out of the Iceberg Lounge. And he's, you know, they think we've finally got him. He's the rat. And he's like, well, you guys all work for me. Don't you know that? And they open the doors and Commissioner Gordon says, well, I guess we don't all work for you. And they're all there like shining their lights on him. And I was like, it read so odd as a choice for me. And I was really curious what everyone else thought about that, because it was the one moment in the film where the reading of cheesy that came out of it was not done in a sort of critical or like commentating way. Like when, like the great moment when he flies underneath the bridge and his parachute gets caught and he hits the top of the car, I laughed out loud. But I think that serves a kind of purpose to show what happens to his character. But that seemed like weirdly explicitly kind of like Blue Lives Matter-ish. Like we're not all corrupt. What did everyone else think of that moment? Because I think that theme is really, really important to the rest of the film. And am I missing something by reading it that way? Is that just surface level message?
It was weird. It felt really out of place, because something that made a lot of sense to me through the rest of the movie was the fact that the cops, both the corrupt ones and the ones that we are pretty sure might not be corrupt or whatever, they all hate him, everyone hates him except for Gordon. Like all the cops are like, you're a crazy person in a bat suit. And Gordon's like, for whatever reason. And another interesting thing is that we never get the backstory of why Gordon trusts him. I think Jeffrey Wright was able to pull that off in a way that not a lot of other actors could have, because it didn't bug me too much, but it bugged me a little, because I'm like, okay, everyone else hates him, but Gordon's like, I really trust this guy and I'm willing to take a punch in the face for him.
They do have a really, really great buddy cop dynamic to sort of lean into the noir aspects. I really liked their kind of back and forth there. And when the Penguin calls it out at one point and is like, aren't you two a pair? Like, it was beautiful. It was a great moment.
It was. No, completely agree. Although I really wish I knew why Gordon trusted him and no one else did. But yeah, it made that bit at the end seem really, really weird. Agreed. Because there were so many obviously corrupt cops in Gotham, but where were all these other guys just hiding while their corrupt pals were doing things? I don't know.
At least it wasn't as bad as the end of The Dark Knight Rises.
Right.
Right.
There's only one police in this town.
I was going to say, you know, the corrupt cops, like this thing, you do kind of have to lean into if you want any kind of sort of quasi-grounded feeling or realistic feeling take on Batman, just because, you know, you have sort of the obvious question, right? Like, you're a billionaire. Why do you think the best way to make the city safer is, like, dressing up in a costume and, like, beating up muggers instead of, you know, funding more police or funding, you know, better public institutions or whatever, which actually, in contrast to the comics, this Bruce Wayne has apparently stopped doing philanthropy. There's a dialogue at one point where another character says, well, the Wayne legacy was all this philanthropy and you don't seem to be doing anything. If you sort of start from the actually all these social institutions are completely corrupt, it starts to make, I don't know if it, I would say it makes sense, but it makes a little more sense that, okay, he's got to do something radically different, you know, because pouring more funds into these institutions, which is what his father tried to do, you're just feeding the corruption. It's not going to help. And so in a sense, right, you wonder then, well, so they're suggesting, aha, there's hope and Falcone's, you know, out of the way now. You know, does that mean, you know, things have changed? You, in a sense, right? If you want to keep having Batman stories, to some extent, you kind of need to preserve the idea that that's still not a solution. That's a viable alternative.
Well, I think if with this movie, I mean, if you're telling a story of redemption and you have so much of the world defined by these corrupt institutions, then you want some sort of arc or scenes in there to reflect almost an arc of the institutions being redeemed in some way and being improved to some extent by Batman's actions. So I think that is like, I guess, the emotional purpose for something like this element of the film, like this through line up until that cringe scene. I guess it's just unfortunate. I mean, this is the thing with Batman comics forever. It's there's that idea of wanting to redeem, an institutional problem with the city's legal system and the city's police. But you kind of get a kind of a dumbed down version of like what like an institutional problem is. And it's like, oh, it just turns out, you know, drug lords are like bribing the cops. And it's like, that's not a very nuanced or sophisticated or, you know, complex take on like what are the incentives that cause, you know, police brutality or police corruption things like that. So you get kind of a simplified arc there with, as if you could just stop police corruption by like, well, now they're not bribed.
Which is really interesting considering, I don't know if this has been done in the comics that it's pulled from, but Selina Kyle at one point, I mean, she makes it explicitly about race at one point when talking about, you know, the rich white boys that are in charge, which to me was really interesting. And, you know, I valued that because while a few years ago it might have sounded like somebody, I don't know, kind of trying to parrot what somebody sounds like, yeah, that is a talking point that comes up now and has a lot of validity to it. And that type of commentary is missing a lot from our superhero stories, or was for many years. You know, now we're getting a lot more of that on the cinematic level. It was happening a lot in comic books, and there's, you know, been a lot of great writers who of color who have, you know, come out and published and redone these stories and retooled them. But on a cinematic level, you know, only in the past maybe 3, 4, 5 years on a large scale has that become part of the story that we are getting. And it's really interesting to me because, as Julian has actually talked about on the show before, because of these sort of weird inherent fascism of superheroes, the fact that, you know, all of this corruption and things are so wrong with the world, but there is this small, you know, group of select special people who have just the precise number of skills and powers who we should all trust to take care of us and solve these things. I mean, especially in a world we live in today where, you know, police officers, you know, bear the Punisher symbol, you know, to sort of, you know, assert authority and put on an air of power, as ironic as using the Punisher symbol would be.
Right, which totally misses the point.
So, like, what does integrating that in Selina Kyle's story, you know, mean when they talk about it there, but then they don't talk about it all with the police there? What is missing? What is the sort of point, and how could they have better done that? I mean, Carolyn, you talked about some of the things that you didn't like that the film could do. Maybe this is a better way to transition to the things that we thought the film could do better. What was missing, and what could they have done to take those things that they might have tiptoed toward, but never, you know, they didn't jump into the pool?
That's you raise a really good point. And in terms of like things that they tiptoed towards, even the comics, even with a black Batman, I think that Batman in particular, and I follow the current arc more than any other superhero arc really out there right now. Like, I usually go back and catch up on other things. But anyway, so there is an Elseworlds sort of story known called White Knight that really addresses like Batman, like what if he's actually the bad guy? And the movie, as you mentioned, kind of tiptoes towards that and does bring up issues of race, which do come up in White Knight, not very satisfyingly, I might note, but it does at least finally take them on a little bit. You're right. It gets mentioned here and then kind of dropped. And it's certainly not really mentioned in regard to the police force at all. It's just, it's brought up in the politics. We have a black candidate running for mayor who is, you know, supposed to be sort of this savior figure. Like had some Obama flavor in there that I thought was a little overdone, but whatever. But yeah, that we're brought up, the race thing comes up in socioeconomic terms, but not in like criminal justice terms specifically. It's just, okay, you're this rich white guy who's very sad and has very floppy hair when he's not being Batman. And what about the rest of us who are just trying to live our damn lives?
So I would say you're just slightly orthogonal, but I have nurse in my head a sort of a Batman BLM kind of story, like Bat Lives Matter, right? Where the sort of premise, it's a little maybe cribbed from White Knight a little bit, but you know, the idea being, okay, at some point, as right in the real world would be inevitable, right? If you're there's a character like Batman who's going around beating people up and dangling people off buildings for information, right? Sooner or later, he is going to, by accident, either seriously injure or kill someone who's either innocent or, you know, guilty of fairly minor crimes, right? It's just he's going to be chasing someone who stole an iPhone and hit them the wrong way, and they're going to crack their head on a wall and die or be paralyzed. That's what would happen in the real world if someone was using violence as much as Batman is, however well trained he is. And then, hey, what would the reaction to that be? You know, especially if you know, the person he injures is non-white, and there's a question of, well, you know, did he react to the threat in a way that was partly based on that? And actually get, you know, maybe some self-examination about, well, God, you know, how much violence am I deploying? Can I really justify this? And I think, the Reeves Batman movie is, you know, sort of tiptoeing towards this in some interesting ways. Because, you know, this Batman is a jerk, right? This is not a nice or heroic character, certainly at the outset. This is a guy who... there's actually a kind of great little scene where he's like sending Selina Kyle in to do surveillance with this like high-tech camera contact lenses, and she basically says, you know, you're just using me, you don't care about my safety. And he kind of grabs her chin, and you think he's gonna like, right, it's a frame setup, so like, oh, you think he's gonna say something reassuring, like, I won't let anything happen. No, he just, you know, tilts her head up. He says, oh, I just want to check your contacts, because she's right, he doesn't care, he's using her. In the, you know, at the very beginning when he's beating those, you know, crooks up, and the victim is as scared of him as the crooks, he seems totally indifferent to this, right? He's not a rescuer. He's just, oh, feels so much better when he gets to beat criminals up. Talking about is a roommate and maybe girlfriend of Selina Kyle, who, is just horribly murdered. Basically because she was having sex with the mayor. It's implied she was a sex worker. And Batman is essentially says, well, you know, she had it coming, but like, well, you know, there are consequences to the bad choices she made. He has the same attitude about the death of Gordon's former partner, who was a corrupt guy. He crossed the line. He was a cop. So you got this Batman with this very kind of Old Testament morality and this very cartoonish, you know, let's say comic booky picture of the world where they're like perfect saints like his parents, who were horribly wronged, and then, right, sinners who deserve limitless violence in repayment for these wrongs. And so if you're not, you know, one of the perfect people, then, well, you deserve whatever you get. He's actually, even to Alfred, he's kind of a jerk, right? At one point in the same scene, he says, says to Alfred, oh, you're not my father. Alfred is visibly kind of wounded by this. Then he offers Bruce his cufflinks, and Bruce kind of scoffs and goes, oh, because they have the Wayne W on them. He goes, oh, you're a Wayne now? Huh. You know, both times, right? He's talking to the guy who raised him since he was 12. The guy is obviously kind of hurt by these remarks because he does sort of think of himself as Bruce's family. Wayne, he doesn't care. You're not really a Wayne. You're not really my dad. I mean, he really is, you know.
I feel like that would have been settled a long time ago. Like, if you're being raised as an orphan, like, wouldn't you be like, when you roll out the you're not my dad thing a lot as a teenager? Like, I feel like that should
Be settled, you have to assume Alfred heard this a lot, Graham. You feel for Andy Serkis' right. Alfred here. You know, this is not a nice guy, and so he's finally kind of called out on this by Selina at one point when he says this kind of awful thing about her girlfriend. Her horrible murder. She made choices and they had consequences. This is someone who is you know, detached, maybe from, you know, the real world, has this very simplistic sense of morality, and is kind of rationalizing what he's doing, all this violence he's dealing out, and that, hey, maybe he's kind of doing this as a very hands-on kind of therapy that doesn't have a whole lot to do with, you know, really trying to make the world a better place or even the city a better place. It's just, you know, I feel a lot better when I get to reenact the night my parents were killed, except the criminals get it instead. And less to do with, well, what do people need? What does the city need? And, you know, we see actually, I think a lot of the trouble he has solving this case come from a lack of perspective taking, right? He's, there's a point where the Riddler releases photos from the Iceberg Lounge that have this important plot effect, and Batman notices these minute clues in the photo, like, oh, the victim was wearing these boots, and then Selina Kyle is wearing the same boots, and he knows that they're connected, and right. He doesn't stop to think, what's the perspective these photos were taken from? Who shot these photos? From what vantage point? Well, the vantage point is Edward Nashton's the Riddler's apartment. Right. So if he'd gone, oh, well, you know, let's trace the line here. That's Riddler's apartment. We movie's over very quickly. In fact, one of the key clues, right, involves this, like, a working class cop who looks at the murder weapon, the very first murder, looks at the murder weapon, says, oh, that's this carpeting tool. And then he looks under the carpet at Riddler's apartment and sees, like, the big map of Riddler's master plan. He clearly didn't recognize earlier what this was, and that it might, you know, be an additional clue. So there's a couple points where, you know, he's this very good detective. He knows all about, you know, corpse decomposition and other, and cryptography and things that help him solve the case. But in some sense, right, he's not good at perspective taking. He doesn't know a whole lot about, like, being a blue collar laborer. And it's that, kind of those end up being the clues he misses, that in a sense cause him to fail, right? This is, like, you know, they catch the Riddler, but they do fail. They don't stop his plan. That Gotham City gets flooded. Again, you know, kind of Batman's arc in this is about recognizing, hey, maybe I've been not doing this for the right reasons, but also, hey, maybe I need to come down from my bat perch a little bit.
You know, it occurs to me that the only Batman movie in which we've gotten him going into therapy is Batman Forever. That's the only time that happened. Whereas, you know, kid Bruce Wayne should have been in a lot of therapy. We never learn anything about that. The closest we get to that is we learn in the Rebirth continuity that he attempted suicide as a teenager. That's all we get. And maybe he had some therapy as a result of that or not. We don't know. But, I mean, Bruce Wayne needed therapy, and it seems like he never got it.
The problem is, in the comics, usually his therapist turns out to be Hugo Strange. or what's his name? Thomas Hurt.
Right.
Simon Hurt? Who is maybe Thomas Wayne? Anyway, yeah. In the comics, so every time Bruce, like, tries to go into therapy, it's a supervillain. Maybe not a great message for the kids.
I really loved the points Julian's making about, I mean, this movie is so different in casting that wealth and privilege of Batman as a source of weakness, really. The obviously the history of Batman is that's been a source of power ever since it's been kind of uneasy ever since he was created. I mean, he's riffing on, you know, he was created purely to imitate Superman following that success, and Superman's more of a 20th century from a working class family, the Kents. Kind of that kind of working class vibe for the Superman stories. Batman is going back to a 19th century hero from the aristocracy, more like the Scarlet Pimpernel. And, like, there's been this uneasy tension, and I absolutely love the way this movie casts these things as actually his source of weakness, because there's this, it's like this epistemic limitation to what he can even see, what vantage points. I love how one of the funniest moments and one of his biggest failures was just he doesn't know Spanish. If he just knew Spanish accurately, he would have solved. He would have avoided so much of the film and gotten and so I love that it recasts his privilege and his power. You know, he's been up in the tower on the, and like this version, he didn't grow up in the the manor, right? He grew up in the tower, up detached from the city, like Julian was saying. I love that he has to get out into the nitty gritty and he kind of fucks up along the way. And I love how he's really, like you guys said, he's a dick to everyone. He's really a huge jerk to Alfred. And I love how, I mean, you both are saying really, in many ways, the villain is Batman. He's a dick even to Bruce, right? Like Bruce's life is a mess because of this persona of Batman. In many ways, it draws on, like Julian said earlier, one of my favorite books, Batman Ego. You know, this monster of Batman is standing in the way of progress more than anyone in the movie.
Would you say there's something in the way?
Shut it down.
Stop before we get copyright struck. Sorry, Carol.
But like this is the first movie, and you know, and in the comics, this is almost never becomes a liability. But his wealth is not a superpower here the way it usually is. I mean, obviously, it gives him fancy bat computers and things like that, but it's not really deployed to the extent that it is in other movies and in many comic book arcs. So
the confusion about who the winged rat is and what metaphor they're trying to use coming up, there's like four different leads they chase down that the winged rat could be, whether it's like it's a stool pigeon, it's a falcon, it's a bat. I was like, no one sat down and made a list.
I was like shouting at the screen.
I really was like, it took this long for some, like, stool pigeon. Yeah. I guess people would say, I don't know. Maybe you see a lot of pigeons if you're up in your tower all the time, or you see a falcon or something, but it's like, have some self-reflection here. And I guess maybe that was the part of it, was that, you know, he's constantly, you know, as much as he's looking inward at himself, he doesn't have an accurate picture of what he is or something like that. But I just couldn't understand the whole time. It was very rarely do I feel the need to shout at the screen, but that was one of them. Especially when early on, Alfred's like, well, he has pretty bad Spanish, but like they plant it so firmly in the beginning that I'm like, even Bruce, I know you're in the movie, but can't you see this is...
Yeah, it bothered, even with my high school Spanish, it bothered me quite a lot too.
I was so relieved that turned out to be a plot point, because I was like, oh God, you know, come on. You couldn't find one Spanish speaker to correct this for you. So I was relieved that was an actual plot point and not just sloppiness. Although I will say, you know, that ambiguity is in there partly because, right, the Riddler's messages to Batman all work on a bunch of different levels, right? On one level, like, it's classic Riddler. These are taunting clues. Come catch me. You know, come solve the mystery I'm laying out. And then later we realize, oh, the Riddler thinks Batman is like his ally and his partner, and he's giving directions. He's feeding Batman information, right? He's making sure Batman learns the picture of the city and the corruption that Batman has, and then gets the message, I need you to bring Falcone out into the light so I can shoot him. But kind of beyond the plot level, right, they also work as, you know, kind of therapeutic messages to Batman, right? If you think about, like, okay, the riddles to the DA, right? I can be cruel, poetic, or blind, but when I'm ignored, it's violence you may find. Batman knows justice, right, is the answer. But what is Batman doing, right? He's running around beating up muggers in a really brutal way. It doesn't seem to be about protecting people. It's not about justice. It's about violence. Since you are justice, please...
I mean, he reminds everyone, right, constantly.
They call him
Ben.
They call him Vengeance in this movie more than they call him Batman. Right, and then the riddle is: if you're justice, please do not lie. What is the price for your blind eye? This is at the plot level about the corruption of the DA is taking bribes, but it's also, hey, Bruce, what is the cost for your inability to, right, like, see what you're actually doing and what your motives are? And then, since your justice is so select, who is the vermin? This is, right, the reference back to the winged rat you're paid to protect. So this needs to be, right, both a reference to the stool pigeon, the vermin that these corrupt officials are protecting, but also, hey, you know, who is it that you've paid this price to protect? Who are you protecting, Bruce? Is it the city, or is it the winged rat? Is it yourself? And in a sense, right, the movie is about Batman kind of coming to see that that's what he's involved in, and the solution is Riddler's last riddle, right, which ends in, you know, bring him into the light and you'll find where I'm at. Hey, what's the solution? It's time for Batman to maybe not skulk in the shadows all the time. You need to bring him out into the light and be a symbol of hope and inspiration, and not just this kind of figure of violence and terror that criminals are scared of, but something that makes people feel protected. So in a lot of ways, right, what's going on here is, you know, the partnership the Riddler imagines at the plot level, but also in a way, a real partnership where this kind of dialogue of riddles is kind of the therapy Bruce needs.
And like you said, it was all the villain the whole time.
Yeah, I thought that was a stroke of genius, the partnership.
I agree, but I enjoyed that aspect of the clues, but I confess my favorite part of those little riddles was really superficial. They were all Easter eggs for other Batman villains. One of the cards had like the mad scientist on it with the shiny glasses. That was obviously strange. There was one of them was a redheaded girl surrounded by plants.
Wow.
Yeah, they were all, I'm trying to remember the rest of them, but yeah, they were all very kind of obvious allusions to other Batman villains.
Really. Now I feel foolish. Oh, if only they, you know, maybe peeled some plastic off one of the card's lips or something. I would have been like, oh, I get it. I know that one.
Well, there was the Mad Hatter one. There was that one. Well, since the first crime was on Halloween, the first one might have, I can't remember, but it was probably a Scarecrow one, but I honestly don't recall. But because I didn't pick up on it until like the second card. I was like, oh, wait.
Well, the layers, the double, the meaning, the layers of meaning with the cards is so genius. Like Julian was saying, they apply to Batman, but then there's also, well, they apply just as much to Riddler because Riddler's inspired by Batman. I mean, he also has as little self-awareness as Bruce about what he's doing. It was such a genius use of Riddler to have it. He thinks he's working with Batman. Batman thinks he's working against Riddler, and they're both sort of wrong. And I love that. Oh, I just loved how they were foiled like that. And also, not just them, but Selina into the mix. I mean, that's why I like that moment, Carolyn, you mentioned where like the you're not my real dad moment. I did like that because I've always thought of Batman as he's fundamentally in a state of arrested development. He hasn't been able to grow up since his parents were killed. And so all the characters in this movie, Selina, the Riddler, and the Batman, were orphans in a state of arrested development. They're dressing up to cope with their trauma. That was a fantastic use of the characters. I loved it.
I looked it up, actually, and Carolyn, the first card is an owl.
Right. So, yes, that was it. Yes.
Another sort of owl, like two Batman. Potential yes. Batman villains there, right? or Owlman even, which I guess the Court of Owls ends up creating a new version of.
I mean, I saw it when I was like there were my friend and I were the only people in the theater, so when I yelled at the screen, it was fine. But
there's like three de facto Adam West Easter eggs. I mean, one, this is the only Batman movie with those four villains, Penguin, Riddler, Catwoman, Joker, since the 66 Adam West movie. And then two, there was that awesome shot of Batman like running down a building, which was like really cool of an action shot, but also invoked, obviously, Adam West and Burt Ward crawling up the buildings. And then third, if you notice in the scene where Riddler mails the bomb and then Alfred gets hurt, there's the Shakespeare bust in his room, which is how they opened the Batcave in the Adam West show.
Right.
So I loved how, I think Matt Reeves, he said he grew up with Adam West Batman. So I love that he peppered in his Easter eggs, even though it's such a different version.
There was another one, and it's such a dumbly deep cut.
Oh, I'm excited.
I'm a little hesitant to mention it, but here I am.
No, tell us.
The name of the commissioner who got murdered, Savage, Peter Savage. He is from an episode of the original of the 66 where Egghead, like he's actually like sort of a, to go back to Hush, he's like another sort of rich person who's kidnapped by Egghead. And then,
oh, that's great. I didn't catch that one. Maybe that means Egghead will be the villain in the sequel.
But then like the Riddler gets involved and like Batman has to like tell the Riddler, they're like, oh, you're the smartest villain in Gotham. It's not really Egghead. But he's like, Egghead, you're the smartest. Anyway. But it's a long journey from rich guy who gets kidnapped to police commissioner, but like clearly, clearly Matt Reeves just loves Batman so much. It just like blew my mind, like at multiple points in that movie. And it was really cool to see as someone who also loves Batman. Like I'm convinced Batfleck was created by someone who was like not a huge Batman fan. You know, what's his name? Doesn't hate Batman as much as he clearly hates Superman. Zack Snyder. I mean, He clearly hates Superman, but that's
you guys want to do an hour on the Zack Snyder reverse?
Let's get started, everybody. Roll tape.
But this was a love letter the way that like the Dark Knight trilogy was not. The Tim Burton original Batman, the first two were very much love letters, kind of in this vein, but not as specific.
I mean, Zack Snyder does like Batman more than he likes Superman, but he likes him like an angsty teenager, right? And he thinks like, oh, you know, Frank Miller's Batman was cool because he kills people and that's awesome.
Right. Yeah. I like him bitter and angry.
It's very similar to, I mean, a lot of fictional characters that people take the wrong lesson from or don't realize how much the work is endorsing or condemning them. This movie itself, the beginning, the voice, to go back to the voiceover, I mean, I got strong Rorschach vibes. And even that is riffing on, you know, Taxi Driver with Travis Bickle. And both, you know, so knowing, getting that sense of like Batman's, okay, and this, he's more like those characters. And he has to obviously grow out of that. He has to, like you said, he has such a retributive morality and trading that for redemptive morality by the end.
Yeah. I really could have done without the last chunk of the movie, as much as I enjoy kind of the callback to Zero Year and No Man's Land and all that, but the flooding of the city, like the whole last bit just felt that could have been in any like Batman superhero movie. Like that didn't feel like it. It felt a little out of place to me in the rest of the film, but I'm pretty sure he shot his leg full of venom. So at least we got that.
Yes. Okay. That makes a lot of sense now that you say it. Cause I was like, it wasn't just like adrenaline shot or so. Okay. I know. I was like, he didn't have a peanut allergy reaction at that moment. So, okay, that was interesting. Yes.
No, it was greenish.
Well, the thing about that scene that bugged me, just like a weird nitpicky thing, is there's all of this scaffolding falling and like water is rushing in and it's full everywhere. And they see this, you know, like one electrical box that like the cable is torn and falling. And, you know, he cuts it and falls and they're like, oh, great. Not everyone's going to get electrocuted. There is so much electrical equipment on that stage. There's so many more people would have died by the like diseases from the flood water and the getting shocked to death from all of the amplification systems and the PA from that than that one box. I was like, no one is like and shaking down in the water there. And yet, gosh, it was the one thing that I feel bad. I hate to be one of those people that points at stuff and is like, that wouldn't actually happen. I'm like, it's a movie. Get over it. But that I was like, we did all this work.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of why it felt out of place. The rest felt really like lived in and normal-ish, I mean, for like a comic book world. And that was just like, what are you doing? And then I really also disliked the end with a cutesy motorcycle chase. That was stupid and garbage. I just think they had that last dialogue bit at the end just to mention Bluehaven. I think they just want to introduce that and make people squeal if they recognize it. I don't know. It was silly.
Yeah, this is a movie that I mean, even after the denouement in the whatever, Madison Square Garden space. This movie does suffer. This is, I think, you know, the best Batman movie, you know, maybe tied with The Dark Knight. But it does suffer a little bit from Return of the King sort of syndrome where, yeah, yes. It's over. Oh, no. Okay. There's another. Okay. Oh, all right. Now is there. No, there's another scene. Okay. Okay. There's that weird kind of exchange between Riddler and presumably Joker that seems like they made a mid-credit scene and then like decided to actually stick it in the movie instead.
In the actual movie.
It just like breaks the kind of flow of the film. And it really does feel like you know, they shot an end credit scene and then like pasted it in somewhere. And then all the stuff at the end.
I did read the director was gonna like, didn't want to include that as part of the main movie, but the audience reaction was just like, so, or like the sample audience, whatever reaction was so positive, he's like, F it, I'll put it in. But that would have definitely worked better as a mid-credit scene.
I thought it was weird towards the end here. I mean, there was that whole big sequence where Batman is saving all of these innocent people. That was weird. I don't tend to see that in super saving innocent people. Is that, I don't think I've rarely seen Batman do that in the films, and barely any superhero movies do that. So that was a bit jarring to see superhero saving people, but.
I mean, it was just a really kind of hit you over the head with that. Hey, he's a better guy now.
Oh, if it's not clear, I love that
instead of vengeance.
I hate that superhero movies do not show them saving innocent people.
The like ne plus ultra of this is, in Snyder's Man of Steel. There's a scene where like Congress or something has been bombed and everything is in flames and people are screaming and running and like Superman is there and he's just sort of like hovering and scowling, not like, oh, you know, flying around, who can I help? So so yeah, I really liked that we're saying, I think I wrote in some of the discussion before it. It had the sort of the feel, even sort of visually, right? I feel like the movie kind of visually changes around this point. And I said, it had the kind of the sensation of you're reading a Frank Miller book and then suddenly like a splash shot from like a late Silver Age Steve Englehart story, right? Like gets dropped into it and you're like, oh, this is, I'm suddenly reading a different kind of era and take on Batman.
Well, that actually reminds me that this movie is like the complete inverse of Man of Steel. Like this gets Batman right in many ways in which Man of Steel got Superman totally wrong. So
another way, it's not the opposite of Man of Steel. I owe this insight to my wife who made it after we saw the movie, and she pointed out how, you know, for years so many Superman movies trade in 9/11 imagery. And so much with Snyder, and this one eschews that. And instead, the end, for all the flaws it may have, the end still worked for me a lot. And it invokes more something like Katrina, more like a natural disaster that you have to rescue people from, not some terrorist attack that could be solved by just bonking the terror. You know, so it's a totally different kind of situation, and it feels like a real divergence from like 20 years of superhero movies going off the same tragedy and trauma. That was a nice difference.
I love that point. That's really, really well done.
Batman is no longer George Bush using the Patriot Act to catch the Joker.
Thanks for listening. As always, the best way to get more Pop and Lock content is to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at the handle @PopandLockPod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock, with an E, like a philosopher, Pod. Make sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and please rate and review us if you like the show. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is a project of libertarianism.org and is produced by me, Landry Ayers. To learn more, visit us on the web at libertarianism.org.